Welcome to Literary Hangover. I'm your host, Matt Leck. With me, Alex Guns.
Hello.
Today, we are doing the Custom House introductory to Nathaniel Hawthorne's Scarlet Letter. It's a short story in and of itself, published in spring 1850 with the Scarlet Letter, but also in some other publications as sort of like a tease for the Scarlet Letter. It's very political. Hawthorne had been working in the customs house in Boston as a surveyor. And he sort of goes into, you know, there might be a certain type of reader who might be annoyed at how much we bring politics into these sorts of stories. But Hawthorne does it himself here because this is basically a political screed that has some sort of literary, some romantic literary formalizing, you know.
It's literary victim blaming. He's making us talk about this.
Basically, what the story is, Hawthorne, as we talked about in Young Goodman Brown, he was born in 1804, went to college throughout the 1820s in Bowdoin, that's in Maine, right, I think. Then he sort of went back to Salem, his hometown, and lived with his mom. It's very... Oh, yeah, I've remembered something I want to bring up here. There's a Jorge Luis Borges essay on Nathaniel Hawthorne that is really hilarious. And I don't want to quote it too at length because this is going through Google Translate. But even through Google Translate, Borges can write...
It's untranslated?
No. Oh, well, yeah, it's untranslated from at least into English as far as I can find.
Wow.
I wasn't able to find it anywhere else on the internet besides immaculadadeception.blogspot.com. Okay, so he goes into a little biography of Nathaniel Hawthorne here. His father, Captain Nathaniel Hawthorne, died in 1808 in the East Indies in Suriname of yellow fever. One of his ancestors, John Hawthorne, was a judge in the witch trials of 1692, in which 19 women, including a slave, Tituba, were sentenced to hang. In those curious processes, in parentheses, now fanaticism has other forms, Justice Hawthorne acted with severity and certainly with sincerity. So conspicuous was it, wrote Nathaniel, our Nathaniel, in the martyrdom of the witches, that it is lawful to think that the blood of those unfortunate left a stain so deep it must last in its old bones in the cemetery of Charter Street. Anyway, this is a part I want to quote. When Captain Hawthorne died, his widow, Nathaniel's mother, retreated to her bedroom on the second floor. On that floor were the bedrooms of his sisters, Louisa and Elizabeth, and the last one, Nathaniel's. These people did not eat together and almost did not talk. They left their food on a tray in the corridor. Nathaniel spent his days writing fantastic stories. At twilight in the afternoon, he went for a walk. That furtive regime of life lasted 12 years. In 1837, he wrote to Longfellow, "I have secluded my life without the slightest intention of doing so, without the slightest suspicion that this was going to happen to me. I have become a prisoner, I have locked myself in a dungeon, and now I no longer have the key, and even if the door were open, I would almost be afraid to leave." So that was Hawthorne's post-college years. And he basically wrote some short stories, two short story collections, Twice Told Tales and Tanglewood Tales. But that wasn't making him very good money, and he needed a real job. So he, being a young Democrat from his college days, he got a gig as a customs house surveyor, and actually, this time in Boston. This is not the one he's referring to in the custom house in Boston. And he was there 1839 to 1841. After that, he goes to Brook Farm and then to Concord, the old manse, spend some time in a Brook Farm, like a utopian community, socialistic community that we'll probably go into in a different episode. And he does that Concord business 1842 to 1845. He basically still needs more money because literature is not paying the bills. And these custom house gigs were very good money. So I want to play... We played a bit of Brenda Wineapple, the biographer, in the previous one, a C-SPAN interview. She did two C-SPAN interviews. This one, she's also with Eliza New, a New York University... Well, I guess Harvard University professor. And here they're talking about... the sort of what the origin of the custom house, a caller calls in.
Hello? Hello? Yeah, you're on the air.
Okay, thanks. I'm calling to ask if any of your literary guests in their research have discovered the basis for Hawthorne's writing The Scarlet Letter. I have heard a story, but I'm anxious to know if they have discovered this in his letters or diaries, which I have heard are in the Boston Public Library.
Did you hear the question?
Yes, the basis for The Scarlet Letter. The source of any literary work is hard to discover. Just how hard Hawthorne himself tells us when, in a sense, he suggests that The Scarlet Letter was born when he lost his job. That is, he had been working at the Salem Custom House earning a living, and a change of political administration meant that he was fired, or as he says, he was decapitated. His head was the first that fell. The catastrophe of that event, and indeed catastrophe in general, prompts him, he tells us in the Custom House, to turn back into himself, to turn into his imagination, and he makes a short work of adapting and then taking up his pen. It's no coincidence, I think, that The Scarlet Letter itself begins with a catastrophic set of affairs where a beautiful young woman in a new land finds herself in the most excruciating position, finds in a way her life over, and yet this catastrophe is just the beginning of her life, as in a way Hawthorne's professional catastrophe, getting fired after all is no joke, is the beginning of his most fertile literary period.
We've got... go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, he actually began The Scarlet Letter. You can see vestiges of it or foreshadowings in some of his other stories, like Endicott and the Red Cross. There's a woman who wears an A in that particular story, and he was very interested in strong heretical women. Anne Hutchinson was another sketch of his. So he did a lot of reading in old wills, old documents, old records, all the kinds of dusty things that you can find in and around Salem. And so he was very interested in the way that the Puritan community dealt with its transgressors.
It wasn't just a firing, right? It was a public firing. Like it was a part of the news cycle at the time that this was a corruption charge. And for someone like Hawthorne, who's an aspiring writer, an aspiring artist, to be fired as like a grifter in the government, I imagine would be like the worst case scenario for someone like that.
So Zachary Taylor, the Whig, wins, and Hawthorne's put there by Democrats. Hawthorne says he should be allowed to stay on because he is not a political figure. He's running his office apolitically. This leads to an investigation in whether that's actually true or not. And it doesn't, I didn't really get into the weeds about whether the charges weren't necessarily true, but I did find it interesting that him sort of saying, I'm this literary man that I should be allowed to have this government post. Some people thought, yeah, definitely. And a lot of people actually in the press, a lot of media figures. However, there's also people who said, why do you deserve just a cush gig like that when like it could be given to a day laborer or something like that, mm-hmm. right? Like you're a writer, who cares? That wasn't like a respected thing at that point.
Yeah, or just as likely that incoming administration is like, yeah, we have our patronage jobs that we need to give out as well, so you need to go.
And Hawthorne does go into it. He basically, I don't think I included this in any of the clips, but he accuses the Whigs of being the only ones who, like they started it basically, right?
Mm-hmm.
The Democrats have to do, they turn Whigs out of office for patronage positions because the Whigs do it to Democrats. But either way, it's
completely unrelatable sentiment.
What's sort of interesting to me about this whole Hawthorne Custom House stuff is he made so much money. He made way more money in either the Custom House at Boston, working for the Custom House at Boston, and then later the bigger job, the Custom House in Salem. He made more money than he made writing his stories, even like the successful ones.
Gosh.
And then later he goes to Liverpool to do basically the same thing. So let's start though with the Custom House, and I actually do think it should be looked at like a bit of political rhetoric. And it starts off the beginning going into his sort of you'd call it a ethos, his sort of roots in the community, how far back he goes.
Custom House, introductory to The Scarlet Letter by Nathaniel Hawthorne.
This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain.
All right, here's Hawthorne on his Salem roots.
In my native town of Salem, at the head of what, half a century ago, in the days of old King Darby, was a bustling wharf, but which is now burdened with decayed wooden warehouses and exhibits...
That King Darby is known as the father of American commerce with India.
What, half a century ago, in the days of old King Darby, was a bustling wharf, but which is now burdened with decayed wooden warehouses, and exhibits few or no symptoms of a commercial life, except perhaps a bark or brig halfway down its melancholy length, discharging hides, or, nearer at hand, a Nova Scotia schooner pitching out her cargo of firewood, at the head, I say, of this dilapidated wharf, which the tide often overflows, and along which, at the base and in the rear of the row of buildings, the track of many languid years is seen in a border of unthrifty grass. Here, with a view from its front windows adown this not very enlivening prospect, and thence across the harbour, stands a spacious edifice of brick. From the loftiest point of its roof, during precisely 3.5 hours of each forenoon, floats or droops, in breeze or calm, the banner of the Republic, but with the 13 stripes turned vertically instead of horizontally, and thus indicating that a civil and not a military post of Uncle Sam's government is here established.
Nice detail.
Its front is ornamented with a portico of half a dozen wooden pillars, supporting a balcony, beneath which a flight of wide granite steps descends towards the street. Over the entrance hovers an enormous specimen of the American eagle, with outspread wings, a shield before her breast, and, if I recollect aright, a bunch of intermingled thunderbolts and barbed arrows in each claw. With the customary infirmity of temper that characterizes this unhappy fowl, she appears, by the fierceness of her beak and eye, and the general truculency of her attitude, to threaten mischief to the inoffensive community, and especially to warn all citizens, careful of their safety, against intruding on the premises which she overshadows with her wings. Nevertheless, vixenly as she looks, many people are seeking, at this very moment, to shelter themselves under the wing of the federal eagle, imagining, I presume, that her bosom has all the softness and snugness of an eiderdown pillow. But she has no great tenderness, even in her best of moods, and sooner or later, oftener soon than late, is apt to fling off her nestlings with a scratch of her claw, a dab of her beak, or a rankling wound from her barbed arrows.
What do you think of what he's saying about the eagle there? People seem to want shelter into it, but actually it'll stick you with an arrow.
As an opening to the story and then an opening to later on for the Scarlet Letter. And if I think it's not too far of a leap to assume that this unnamed custom house narrator is a cipher for Nathaniel Hawthorne, that he's signaling that symbols are going to be important and that we live under symbols that have drastically different meanings based on in different circumstances.
Right.
How about you?
No, I think that's exactly it. I also am very suspicious of maybe some small governmentism going on already in the Democrats.
Well, Mother Eagle can only look after so many.
Yeah, exactly.
Children.
Yeah.
A scratch of her claw, a dab of her beak, or a rankling wound from her barbed arrows. The pavement round about the above-described edifice, which we may as well name at once as the Custom House of the Port, has grass enough growing in its chinks to show that it has not, of late days, been worn by any multitudinous resort of business. In some months of the year, however, there often chances a forenoon when affairs move onward with a livelier tread. Such occasions might remind the elderly citizen of that period, before the last war with England, when Salem was a port by itself. Not scorned as she is now by her own merchants and shipowners, who permit her wharves to crumble to ruin, while their ventures go to swell, needlessly and imperceptibly, the mighty flood of commerce at New York or Boston. On some such morning, when 3 or 4 vessels happen to have arrived at once, usually from Africa or South America, or to be on the verge of their departure thitherward, there is a sound of frequent feet passing briskly up and down the granite steps. Here, before his own wife has greeted him, you may greet the sea-flushed shipmaster just in port. with his vessel's papers under his arm in a tarnished tin box. Here, too, comes his owner, cheerful or sombre, gracious or in the sulks, according as his scheme of the now accomplished voyage has been realized in merchandise that will readily be turned to gold.
When Hawthorne says, such occasions might remind the elderly citizen of that period before the last war with England, when Salem was a port by itself, not scorned as she is now by her own merchants and shipowners, who permit her wharves to crumble to ruin while their ventures go to swell, needlessly and imperceptibly, the mighty flood of commerce at New York and Boston. That was a result of Thomas Jefferson trade war over with Britain and France because they were fighting. And he's like, oh, this is annoying. So he decided closing ports, the Salem port especially, which was a very, very active port. I think even more so than Boston. Like I said, it had the connections to India. I think it had a connection to China too. Hawthorne's dad, in fact, was an officer aboard a ship called, I think, the American, that brought the first elephant to the United States in 1796. They loaded it aboard, found out rather quickly that it was drinking all of the drinking water, and switched it to alcohol. And then by the time they got to the United States, they basically realized, hey, we're going to have to advertise this as an alcoholic elephant. And that's God. There's nothing sort of sad about that story at all.
That's the glory days of this port, by the way.
Well, that's the sort of end. That's like the sort of like the last.
Oh,
you
I
got
see.
Like 10 more years before that embargo comes.
Yeah, yeah. They're like, this is the zenith point.
Trade wars are good and easy to win. I have some from a previously cited historian Alan Taylor.
Maybe it's misplaced, but I read in the story that the narrator was condemning Salem for even taking part in international trade. That like this was the inevitable end to doing something like that, rather than being its like previous colonial self, which is like inward facing. But maybe it just wasn't there.
I think Hawthorne generally is supportive of the trade. I think it's more like the America as a young country at this point. You still look around and you see crumbling ports and you see things that are hundreds of years off their like heyday, right?
Mm-hmm.
That sort of it reminds you of the Eric Hobsbawm invention of tradition.
Oh.
Right? Like even though this is we should conceivably still be in a time of negotiating what national character is, you have all these different sort of signifiers and cultural touchstones that make it seem sort of settled already. I don't know, maybe that's slightly different than what Hawthorne's seeing when he looks around at the wharf and sees it being sort of let. I mean, that is another reason to be an anti-government activist if you're Hawthorne, right? Like, mm-hmm. You should have just let us keep free trading, but instead now Salem is falling backwards. Here is this bit from the Civil War of 1812. American Citizens, British Subjects, Irish Rebels, and Indian Allies by Alan Taylor. On the basically the ending of Jefferson's embargo.
By early 1809, however, most Northern Republicans had soured on a policy that had weakened them by reviving the Federalists. To hold the party together, the Republicans in Congress terminated the embargo on March 4th, 1809, Jefferson's last day in office. The ill-conceived embargo had weakened the United States. Because duties on foreign trade primarily funded the federal government, the embargo depleted the treasury, and the embargo trained people along the border to defy their own government, which augured poorly for their support in case of war. Once considered easy, an American invasion of Canada became a far trickier proposition in the wake of the embargo. But invasion became the prime American policy option after the embargo had inevitably failed.
So, as Trump likes to say, trade wars are good and easy to win.
Yeah.
Let's go back to the text, the custom house here. So now Hawthorne specifically goes into his ancestors here a bit later.
It is now nearly 2 centuries and a quarter since the original Briton, the earliest emigrant of my name, made his appearance in the wild and forest-bordered settlement which has since become a city. And here his descendants have been born and died, and have mingled their earthy substance with the soil, until no small portion of it must necessarily be akin to the mortal frame wherewith, for a little while, I walk the streets. In part, therefore, the attachment which I speak of is the mere sensuous sympathy of dust for dust. Few of my countrymen can know what it is, nor, as frequent transplantation is perhaps better for the stock, need they consider it desirable to know. But the sentiment has likewise its moral quality. The figure of that first ancestor, invested by family tradition with a dim and dusky grandeur, was present to my boyish imagination as far back as I can remember. It still haunts me, and induces a sort of home feeling with the past, which I scarcely claim in reference to the present phase of the town. I seem to have a stronger claim to a residence here on account of this grave, bearded, sable-cloaked, and steeple-crowned progenitor, who came so early with his Bible and his sword, and trode the unworn street with such a stately port, and made so large a figure as a man of war and peace, a stronger claim than for myself, whose name is seldom heard, and my face hardly known. He was a soldier, legislator, judge. He was a ruler in the church. He had all the puritanic traits, both good and evil. He was likewise a bitter persecutor.
I think that is very revealing. You know, in the comment I read out prior to the Maypole and Marymount, the Hawthorne basically, he thinks there's good and evil to the Puritan outlook, which I think that is, he's not a complete one thing or the other politically in all this stuff. He's basically perpetually conflicted, and sort of he draws his romance from the sort of conflict of those sorts of things, I think.
Yeah.
Legislator, judge. He was a ruler in the church. He had all the puritanic traits, both good and evil. He was likewise a bitter persecutor, as witness the Quakers, who have remembered him in their histories, and relate an incident of his hard severity towards a woman of their sect, which will last longer, it is to be feared, than any record of his better deeds, although these were many. His son, too, inherited the persecuting spirit, and made himself so conspicuous in the martyrdom of the witches that their blood may fairly be said to have left a stain upon him. So deep a stain, indeed, that his old dry bones in the Charter Street burial ground must still retain it, if they have not crumbled utterly to dust. I know not whether these ancestors of mine bethought themselves to repent and ask pardon of heaven for their cruelties, or whether they are now groaning under the heavy consequences of them in another state of being. At all events, I, the present writer, as their representative, hereby take shame upon myself for their sakes, and pray that any curse incurred by them, as I have heard, and as the dreary, unprosperous condition of the race for many a long year back would argue to exist, may be now and henceforth removed.
When Hawthorne references a curse there, his ancestor, the one that was a judge during the Salem witch trials, actually was cursed by one of the witches. And what was said was, it's a really good... really good curse, actually. I'd be freaked out by it, and I'm not superstitious at all. This is from themystica.com, which is one of my favorite websites. As a young man, Nathaniel had been fascinated and deeply moved by the family story that Judge Hawthorne was cursed by one of the convicted witches. The convicted witch, while accompanied by others, issued a curse on her way to the Salem gallows. When Reverend Nicholas Nyas asked her to confess, Sarah Good explained, "I am no more a witch than you are a wizard, and if you take my life, God will give you blood to drink." It is known that Noyes choked on his own blood in 1717.
Sick.
I can't remember what it was, but it was some sort of like thing where he vomited up blood and choked on it, so it's pretty awesome.
I would hate to be in that room. I can also know about, like, I'm sure he talked about it from time to time, being like, yeah, I can't believe this witch cursed me with this.
Imagine like being like a Richard Dawkins type atheist, and that guy gets time traveled. He gets resuscitated in time travel, and Richard Dawkins has to like convince him that God doesn't exist.
Like, he's the worst character in literature.
He's like, I'm sorry, Mr. Dawkins, but I choked on my own blood after a witch told me that I would. So you'll forgive me if I don't, you know, hold much weight with your skepticism.
And he just ends with puking up his own blood.
Yeah. Maybe that's how Richard Dawkins goes too.
Doubtless, however, either of these stern and black-browed Puritans would have thought it quite a sufficient retribution for his sins that after so long a lapse of years the old trunk of the family tree, with so much venerable moss upon it, should have borne, as its topmost bough, an idler like myself. No aim that I have ever cherished would they recognise as laudable. No success of mine, if my life beyond its domestic scope had ever been brightened by success, would they deem otherwise than worthless, if not positively disgraceful. What is he, murmurs one grey shadow of my forefathers to the other, a writer of story-books? What kind of a business in life, what mode of glorifying God or being serviceable to mankind in his day and generation may that be? Why, the degenerate fellow might as well have been a fiddler. Such are the compliments bandied between my great-grandsires and myself across the gulf of time. And yet, let them scorn me as they will, strong traits of their nature have intertwined themselves with mine.
And like that, what, he has no proof of them saying that, and they most definitely did not say that about him, since they didn't know he existed.
Right.
But he's like, let them insult me. It's like, you just made this up.
Yeah, this is in your head.
Yeah, man, it's like, relax. It's like,
they don't give a shit about what I do.
It's I guess they've been talking some nasty things. Well, guess what? I don't give a fuck.
It's yeah. Like,
okay.
I mean, they probably would have thought he was blasphemous.
Yeah.
I mean, the people that were still really religious were a bit uncomfortable by the Scarlet Letter itself, but yeah, like... A writer of storybooks, he should have been a fiddler.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, fiddlers are well respected these days. They call them violinists now.
True. He should have been a concert pianist.
All right. When I say this was a political tract, this is sort of where we're getting at here. Hawthorne takes aim at the Whigs that are sort of like have been there forever in a sort of way that he kind of reminds me of, you know how Trump sort of sends his lackeys into different departments to sort of like scare the deep state slash, you know, bureaucrats who have been, you know, doing their jobs and say the EPA for 20
reporting
years
on global warming.
Yeah. And Hawthorne comes in and at one point he's like laughing at how panicked they get at elections and stuff like that. I want to let's go into him describing the people that he works with a little bit.
I felt it almost as a destiny to make Salem my home, so that the mould of features and cast of character which had all along been familiar here. Ever, as one representative of the race lay down in his grave, another assuming, as it were, his sentry march along the main street, might still in my little day be seen and recognised in the old town. Nevertheless, this very sentiment is an evidence that the connection, which has become an unhealthy one, should at last be severed. Human nature will not flourish any more than a potato if it be planted and replanted for too long a series of generations in the same worn-out soil. My children have had other birthplaces, and so far as their fortunes may be within my control, shall strike their roots into unaccustomed earth. On emerging from the old manse, it was chiefly this strange, indolent, unjoyous attachment for my native town that brought me to fill a place in Uncle Sam's brick edifice, when I might as well, or better, have gone somewhere else.
So that's a lie. It's not true that he was just homesick. That's the reason he went back to Salem. It was because he needed money really bad. He had kids on the way. Let's see if I can find this quote here. Hawthorne starts putting himself out there to try to get this job, and he says Brenda Wineapple from the Hawthorne to Life says, nor did the Whigs oppose Hawthorne's candidacy. George Hillard backed Hawthorne, and Charles Sumner pleaded with Elizabeth Bancroft. Poor Hawthorne, that sweet, gentle, true nature, has not wherewithal to live. So this is, he did the Utopian Farm Project in, you know, the early 1840s, and then he lives in Concord at the old manse writing short stories and sort of like talking to Emerson and the Transcendentalists, but he's completely poor. And so it says, it was true. With Sophia pregnant again, the baby was due in spring 1846. Hawthorne was almost frantic. What a devil of a pickle I should be in, he told Bridge, if the baby should come and the office should not.
Oh, he's like, I can't help myself but be a little literary.
Yeah, his suit against Ripley had not been blah, blah, blah. Yeah, so yeah, he needed this job quite a bit. So this is political rhetoric, right? This is not actual autobiography.
Yeah, yeah. But I do think that it was probably complex to come back to the town where he grew up on. He said he had come back numerous times, right? Like in
right.
boyhood
yeah.
and childhood. I find that very relatable as someone who's like a transplant as well, and so are you.
Right.
It's complex, like going back home, and I think in this story that Hawthorne touches on that complex relationship you have with your previous home really well. Like the thing of you want to come back, but you don't want to live there, but you do want everyone there to be like, oh my, you are my better, basically. At least that's I get from that story, and how it's annoying that he's not as famous and as important as he should be.
Yeah, and it's also, I think, the case that he avoided going to D.C. When he could have. So yeah, yeah.
That I had gone away, as it seemed, permanently, but yet returned like the bad halfpenny, or as if to have gone somewhere else. My doom was on me. It was not the first disattachment for my native had other birthplaces, and so far as their fortunes may be within my control, shall strike their roots into unaccustomed earth. On emerging from the old manse, it was chiefly this strange, indolent, unjoyous attachment for my native town that brought me to fill a place in Uncle Sam's brick edifice, when I might as well, or better, have gone somewhere else. My doom was on me. It was not the first time, nor the second, that I had gone away, as it seemed, permanently, but yet returned like the bad halfpenny, or as if Salem were for me the inevitable centre of the universe. So one fine morning I ascended the flight of granite steps with the President's commission in my pocket and was introduced to the corps of gentlemen who were to aid me in my weighty responsibility as Chief Executive Officer of the Custom House. I doubt greatly, or rather I do not doubt at all, whether any public functionary of the United States, either in the civil or military line, has ever had such a patriarchal body of veterans under his orders as myself. The whereabouts of the oldest inhabitant was at once settled when I looked at them. For upwards of 20 years before this epoch, the independent position of the collector had kept the Salem Custom House out of the whirlpool of political vicissitude, which makes the tenure of office generally so fragile. A soldier, New England's most distinguished soldier, he stood firmly on the pedestal of his gallant services, and himself secure in the wise liberality of the successive administrations through which he had held office, he had been the safety of his subordinates in many an hour of danger and heartquake. General Miller was radically conservative, a man over whose kindly nature habit had no slight influence, attaching himself strongly to familiar faces, and with difficulty moved to change, even when change might have brought unquestionable improvement. Thus, on taking charge of my department, I found few but aged men. They were ancient sea captains for the most part, who, after being tossed on every sea, and standing up sturdily against life's tempestuous blast, had finally drifted into this quiet nook, where, with little to disturb them except the periodical terrors of a presidential election, they, one and all, acquired a new lease of existence. Though by no means less liable than their fellow men to age and infirmity, they had evidently some talisman or other that kept death at bay. Two or three of their number, as I was assured, being gouty and rheumatic, or perhaps bedridden, never dreamt of making their appearance at the Custom House during a large part of the year, but after a torpid winter would creep out into the warm sunshine of May or June, go lazily about what they termed duty, and at their own leisure and convenience betake themselves to bed again. I must plead guilty to the charge of abbreviating the official breath of more than one of these venerable servants of the Republic. They were allowed, on my representation, to rest from their arduous labours, and soon afterwards, as if their sole principle of life had been zeal for their country's service, as I verily believe it was, withdrew to a better world. It is a pious consolation to me that through my interference a sufficient space was allowed them for repentance of the evil and corrupt practices into which, as a matter of course, every Custom House officer must be supposed to fall. Neither the front nor the back entrance of the Custom House opens on the road to paradise. The greater part of my officers were Whigs. It was well for their venerable brotherhood that the new surveyor was not a politician, and though a faithful Democrat in principle, neither received nor held his office with any reference to political services. Had it been otherwise, had an active politician been put into this influential post to assume the easy task of making head against a Whig collector whose infirmities withheld him from the personal administration of his office, hardly a man of the old corps would have drawn the breath of official life within a month after the exterminating angel had come up the Custom House steps. According to the received code in such matters, it would have been nothing short of duty in a politician to bring every one of those white heads under the axe of the guillotine. It was plain enough to discern that the old fellows dreaded some such discourtesy at my hands. It pained, and at the same time amused me, to behold the terrors that attended my advent, to see a furrowed cheek, weather-beaten by half a century of storm, turn ashy pale at the glance of so harmless an individual as myself, to detect, as one or another addressed me, the tremor of a voice which, in long past days, had been wont to bellow through a speaking trumpet, hoarsely enough to frighten Boreas himself to silence.
The way he characterized them is almost like lizard-like, right? They're like these old like lizards that have got like a patronage, a nice cushy gig, and they get to just sit around in a Custom House, come in when they want, walk the docks.
Yeah, they have this air of like living ghosts almost, that they're already dead because they're not interacting with life in any kind of serious or strenuous way.
And it does, like, I'm sorry I keep bringing this back, but it does sound like this is, it's somewhat amusing as political satire, but it also sounds like it's like conservative assholery about, you know, like government employees, right? Like
waste, fraud, and abuse.
Yeah, like it's like Hawthorne would go to like the DMV and like notice somebody just like sort of relaxing and checking their phone and be like, "Can you believe we pay people to check their phone?"
Yeah, it's like, "What the fuck are you doing there, dude?" It's just like it's a patronage job. Like, relax.
Yeah, and I also think there's something a bit, you know, like you take amusement at the at you know, these old dudes being like, "Okay, this young kid's gonna ruin this for us."
Yeah.
Anyway,
it has the sarcasm and the ironic detachment of describing someone in the way they would like to be described, but just turning it on its head ever so slightly has this kind of protean Twain feel to it. Like you can feel where Mark Twain is going to burst out of in like 30 years from here.
Yeah, interesting. I didn't make that connection, but that makes a lot of sense. Let's keep going a little
bit. And as regarded some of them, weighted by their own lack of efficiency for business, they ought to have given place to younger men, more orthodox in politics, and altogether fitter than themselves to serve our common uncle. I knew it too, but could never quite find in my heart to act upon the knowledge, much and deservedly to my own discredit, therefore, and considerably to the detriment of my official conscience. They continued, during my incumbency, to creep about the wharves and loiter up and down the custom-house steps. They spent a good deal of time, also, asleep in their accustomed corners, with their chairs tilted back against the wall, awaking, however, once or twice in a forenoon, to bore one another with the several thousandth repetition of old sea stories and mouldy jokes that had grown to be passwords and countersigns among them. The discovery was soon made, I imagine, that the new surveyor had no great harm in him. So, with lightsome hearts and the happy consciousness of being usefully employed, in their own behalf at least, if not for our beloved country, these good old gentlemen went through the various formalities of office. Sagaciously, under their spectacles, did they peep into the holds of vessels. Mighty was their fuss about little matters, and marvellous sometimes, the obtuseness that allowed greater ones to slip between their fingers.
This is actually pretty funny.
Whenever such a mischance occurred, when a wagon load of valuable merchandise had been smuggled ashore, at noonday perhaps, and directly beneath their unsuspicious noses, nothing could exceed the vigilance and alacrity with which they proceeded to lock and double lock, and secure with tape and sealing wax, all the avenues of the delinquent vessel. Instead of a reprimand for their previous negligence, the case seemed rather to require a eulogium on their praiseworthy caution, after the mischief had happened, a grateful recognition of the promptitude of their zeal, the moment that there was no longer any remedy.
Which I think that is a hilarious sort of characterization of something that I think all of us can relate to.
Yeah.
Like, I fucked up, so I'm going to be, like, all you can really do is just be extra good the next time.
Yeah. And not even extra good, just, like, more visibly quick in front of everyone. Be like, I'm fixing it, or I'm going to be really good this time.
Yeah, and I also think there's, I don't know if... Maybe it's uncharitable to take a shot at the nowadays Democrats and
the ruling
what
party.
Happened with 2016 and sort of like look at us, we all get this now. We're all on the same page when it comes to, you know, speaking to the right voters or something like that, right? Like, or, you know, having the right policies.
Oh, is this like their midterm strategy you're talking about?
I don't know. I just feel like nobody really wants to take the blame.
Oh,
everyone's
yeah.
got the plan of how to fix it, though.
Yeah. There was no mea culpa, I guess. Yeah. I'm curious to see what you think, but I really like this story just as a piece of literature. But I think having now read a number of Hawthorne's pieces, he stripped away so many of the flowery aspects of his prose, and has interwoven this kind of King James cadence with a sardonic detachment. In a way that it's all, if you just were to take the sentence and pull it out of the story, you'd be almost unable to ply those two pieces apart. Like it's craft. It's both stripped down, but also the craft is much deeper, I feel like, than the short stories we've read before.
Mm. You mean just like his maturity as a writer?
Yeah.
Yeah. I think and it is hard to tell because what we've read is a sort of shorter. We've read The Scarlet Letter too, but. I definitely can see, you know, it's not quite as pronounced to me as the leap between James Fenimore Cooper's The Spy and The Pioneers, which is like 2 years, and it's just like, oh, this guy can actually write now.
Yeah.
But I see what you mean. Like, it'd be interesting to read some of the, I should go back and read some of the prefaces to his short story collections and see what his writing is like in those, actually. Hawthorne goes into, goes into detail on like three other of the old Whigs that are hanging out at the customs house. And I don't think that's super interesting. I think it's just demonstrative of, you know, Hawthorne's objection that he's not being political in the midst of taking political shots on people, characterizing them as basically geriatrics in some sort of like waiting room
before death.
Yeah,
it's kind of insane that he gave this much real estate to these characters.
Yeah,
they listed them. He lined them all up, and he's like, "And here's this one." And he's like, "I get it." Right after I just praised his like slicker presentation.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's the interesting thing about this is it's not there's a purpose to what he's writing here.
Yeah.
Which is he's not being forthright about it. Which is fine. Like I think that's fine, but it's
don't
partisan.
Read liars.
Right? Like you don't expect this sort of the Scarlet Letter writer who has never like controversial enough to take him out of the syllabus at any point in American history.
Yeah,
I read one piece where maybe his low point was during the height of like 1980s American exceptionalism because we didn't want to confront that we can, you know, go off the rails in certain ways, like the community, the anti-Hester Prynne sort of stuff.
Yeah.
But so he goes on and he takes shots at a number of other characters in the custom house. And then he goes into sort of what his role there.
Meanwhile, there I was, a surveyor of the revenue, and so far as I have been able to understand, as good a surveyor as need be. A man of thought, fancy, and sensibility, had he 10 times the surveyor's proportion of those qualities, may at any time be a man of affairs, if he will only choose to give himself the trouble. My fellow officers and the merchants and sea captains with whom my official duties brought me into any manner of connection viewed me in no other light and probably knew me in no other character. None of them, I presume, had ever read a page of my indicting or would have cared a fig the more for me if they had read them all. Nor would it have mended the matter in the least had those same unprofitable pages been written with a pen like that of Burns or of Chaucer, each of whom was a custom house officer in his day as well as I.
That's awesome.
Yeah, that's a... You know, I have my, you know, my own personal ambitions to do stuff besides like the job that I'm currently in.
Right.
And I read a lot of literary biographies and a lot of biographies of artists. And anytime, even it doesn't matter how mundane it is, if they have done it sometime in my life, I'd be like, oh, thank God.
Right. Yeah. I feel like where I'm at now with Majority Report, I grandiosely, I'm like, oh, Orwell was at the New Statesman.
Yeah. Like, yeah.
Yeah. That sort of thing. Right. Like, back when a lot of, or even, you talk about like, wasn't, Einstein also, he was a patent office clerk.
Yes.
Right. But those sort of bourgeois state jobs, they're good. And the state should make more of those so we can all have them.
Yeah. I always think of like Kushner, right? He was like writing Angels in America while he was a switchboard operator from like 8 p.m. to 3 a.m.
Mm.
Just like switching people's calls and also writing like one of the great masterpieces in American theater.
I wonder if you could just listen to people's calls and just get ideas for stories.
Yeah, they're on the phone with like an angel, and he's like, wait a minute.
It is a good lesson, though it may often be a hard one, for a man who has dreamt of literary fame and of making for himself a rank among the world's dignitaries by such means, to step aside out of the narrow circle in which his claims are recognised, and to find how utterly devoid of significance beyond that circle is all that he achieves and all he aims at. I know not that I especially needed the lesson, either in the way of warning or rebuke, but at any rate I learnt it thoroughly. Nor, it gives me pleasure to reflect, did the truth, as it came home to my perception, ever cost me a pang, or require to be thrown off in a sigh. In the way of literary talk, it is true, the naval officer, an excellent fellow who came into office with me and went out only a little later, would often engage me in a discussion about one or the other of his favourite topics, Napoleon or Shakespeare. The collector's junior clerk, too, a young gentleman who, it was whispered, occasionally covered a sheet of Uncle Sam's letter paper with what, at the distance of a few yards, looked very much like poetry, used now and then to speak to me of books as matters with which I might possibly be conversant. This was my all of lettered intercourse, and it was quite sufficient for my necessities.
That's my one of my favourite details, that like the guy, he has two subjects, Napoleon and Shakespeare.
Also that they might be in competition with each other. It's like, it's Napoleon or Shakespeare.
Which that is
like,
true.
It's like, they have nothing to do with each other.
But they are, it is English versus France.
Yeah, yeah, right? Yeah, that's true. The two greatest generals. One a military one, one a general of words.
I mean, what is it now? Like you it's like World War II or Elvis or something like that?
Yeah, it would be like, World War II or the Beatles.
Yeah.
No longer seeking nor caring that my name should be blazoned abroad on title pages, I smiled to think that it had now another kind of vogue. The custom house marker imprinted it, with a stencil and black paint, on pepper bags and baskets of annatto, and cigar boxes and bales of all kinds of dutiable merchandise, in testimony that these commodities had paid the impost and gone regularly through the office. Born on such queer vehicle of fame, a knowledge of my existence, so far as a name conveys it, was carried where it had never been before, and I hope will never go again. But the past was not dead. Once in a great while, the thoughts that had seemed so vital and so active, yet had been put to rest so quietly, revived again. One of the most remarkable occasions when the habit of bygone days awoke in me was that which brings it within the law of literary propriety to offer the public the sketch which I am now writing. In the second story of the custom house, there is a large room in which the brickwork and naked rafters have never been covered with panelling and plaster. The edifice, originally projected on a scale adapted to the old commercial enterprise of the port, and with an idea of subsequent prosperity destined never to be realised, contains far more space than its occupants know what to do with. This airy hall, therefore, over the collector's apartments, remains unfinished to this day, and in spite of the aged cobwebs that festoon its dusky beams, appears still to await the labour of the carpenter and mason. At one end of the room, in a recess, were a number of barrels, piled one upon another, containing bundles of official documents. Large quantities of similar rubbish lay lumbering the floor. It was sorrowful to think how many days and weeks and months and years of toil had been wasted on these musty papers, which were now only an encumbrance on earth, and were hidden away in this forgotten corner, never more to be glanced at by human eyes. But then what reams of other manuscripts, filled not with the dullness of official formalities, but with the thought of inventive brains and the rich effusion of deep hearts, had gone equally to oblivion, and that, moreover, without serving a purpose in their day, as these heaped-up papers had, and, saddest of all, without purchasing for their writers the comfortable livelihood which the clerks of the custom house had gained by these worthless scratchings of the pen. Yet not altogether worthless, perhaps, as materials of local history. Here, no doubt, statistics of the former commerce of Salem might be discovered, and memorials of her princely merchants, old King Darby, old Billy Gray, old Simon Forrester, and many another magnate in his day, whose powdered head, however, was scarcely in the tomb before his mountain pile of wealth began to dwindle. The founders of the greater part of the families which now composed the aristocracy of Salem might here be traced from the petty and obscure beginning of their traffic, at periods generally much posterior to the Revolution, upward to what their children look upon as long-established rank. Prior to the Revolution, there is a dearth of records, the earlier documents and archives of the Custom House having, probably, been carried off to Halifax, when all the King's officials accompanied the British Army in its flight from Boston. It has often been a matter of regret with me, for going back, perhaps, to the days of the Protectorate, those papers must have contained many references to forgotten or remembered men, and to antique customs, which would have affected me with the same pleasure as when I used to pick up Indian arrowheads in the field near
the
old
manse. We mentioned in Young Goodman Brown that Hawthorne is sort of a proto-Adam Curtis.
Yes.
Adam Curtis, the documentarian who basically trolls through BBC archives and dispatch footage that often wasn't used for amazingly sort of poetic cinematic footage. Hawthorne is doing this exact same thing with this documents that he finds in the Salem Custom House. I also really like the detail that they overbuilt the Custom House. They had that giant room that they basically didn't finish. That makes me like, I wonder if there's population data for Salem. Because we have these ideas that have been built up over time of these cities, but these were new at the time, right? They were provincial outposts, and in comparison to what we think of today, they were small towns. I could think of a building in North Dakota that was overbuilt in a similar way. Like we have this real estate, we have the building power. Let's just like build it, and we're going to, like, Bismarck is growing at pace with St. Paul, so we can build this massive warehouse.
And then look out, St. Paul.
St. Louis. And it basically doesn't turn out that way because, you know, whether it's in Bismarck's case, like, it's cold and it's tougher to protect against Native Americans up there, and whether it's Salem's case, Thomas Jefferson embargoes your ass. I really like that passage. It's a very interesting
imaginative. Yeah, that's interesting. I read it as a comment on Salem at the time, which is this town in decline, and there's these rooms that are of no use anymore.
Right.
As this kind of stark contrast to the Salem of bygone, which is everything had a use, everything had a purpose.
There's a strong, like, decline porn, like pictures of Detroit,
yeah,
type of thing.
Well, that's why I think this story, I guess why I feel like it has, why I'm attracted to it, is it resonates in a way that he's talking and feeling things that are, you cannot escape in American discourse in 2018 when talking about decay and talking about past greatness. And this is 1850? When was this?
Yep, from? 1850.
Like, you can see how far back that mentality goes back, almost nearly to the beginning of the American story.
Yeah, and so we come to find that in this sort of rich area of material history that Hawthorne finds at his custom house, he finds something else that comes from... I don't want to play a passage from this, but a previous surveyor at the custom house named Jonathan Pugh was buried at a church, and he was later, Hawthorne read, his remains were dug up as they were doing something to the edifice of that church. As they exhumed his body, they also found some documents, among which are a number of interesting things. We'll get to that later. But I wanted to... There's this end of this paragraph here. It's very interesting. Hawthorne, I don't know, glibness? Or he's like flipping Hawthorne. He says... So this is after they've dug up the body. Nothing, if I rightly call to mind, was left of my respected predecessor, save an imperfect skeleton and some fragments of apparel, and a wig of majestic frizzle, which, unlike the head that it once adorned, was in very satisfactory preservation. But on examining the papers, which the parchment commission served the envelope, I found more traces of Mr. Pugh's mental part, and the internal operations of his head, than the frizzled wig had contained of the venerable skull itself. Like, that is... I mean, maybe they were just less freaked out by skulls and skeletons back then. But it seems weird, like, okay, this guy used to have my job. They dug up his bones, and he had a big frizzly wig, and his skeleton was frankly imperfect.
Yeah.
if we're going to comment upon that.
Yeah, at least compared to his wig.
Yeah. And yeah,
I mean, like, he's dead. Like, just leave him alone, man.
Like, I found more traces of Mr. Pugh's mental part in the internal operations of his head than the frizzled wig had contained of the venerable skull itself. So there's more.
Before that line, I thought there was some sort of comparison between, you know, non-living things like the wig and living things, which is, you know, they pass away. And, like, you know, he's talking about dust, admiring dust, referring to himself when he goes to Salem. But then he just starts talking about his mental state, which is like, okay, I don't know what, you've lost me.
Mm-hmm.
Like, yeah, I think it is a jab that maybe it's just some dead wig.
So here's the most important thing that Hawthorne finds among his predecessor's sort of supply of unearthed, exhumed documents.
So far as they go, into a regular history of Salem, should my veneration for the natal soil ever impel me to so pious a task. Meanwhile, they shall be at the command of any gentleman inclined and competent to take the unprofitable labour off my hands. As a final disposition, I contemplate depositing them with the Essex Historical Society. But the object that most drew my attention in the mysterious package was a certain affair of fine red cloth, much worn and faded. There were traces about it of gold embroidery, which, however, was greatly frayed and defaced, so that none or very little of the glitter was left. It had been wrought, as was easy to perceive, with wonderful skill of needlework, and the stitch, as I am assured by ladies conversant with such mysteries, gives evidence of a now-forgotten art, not to be recovered even by the process of picking out the threads. This rag of scarlet cloth, for time and wear and a sacrilegious moth, had reduced it to little other than a rag, on careful examination, assumed the shape of a letter. It was the capital letter A. By an accurate measurement, each limb proved to be precisely 3 inches and a quarter in length. It had been intended, there could be no doubt, as an ornamental article of dress, but how it was to be worn, or what rank, honour, and dignity, in bypassed times, were signified by it, was a riddle which, so evanescent are the fashions of the world in these particulars, I saw little hope of solving. And yet it strangely interested me. my eyes fastened themselves upon the old scarlet letter and would not be turned aside. Certainly there was some deep meaning in it, most worthy of interpretation, and which, as it were, streamed forth from the mystic symbol, subtly communicating itself to my sensibilities, but evading the analysis of my mind.
You know what this passage reminds me of very strongly, and I don't think I'll be able to read the book similarly after this, is The Crying of Lot 49.
Oh, in what part?
Like the way that the Tristero imagery and the sort of like artifacts and signs that, I forget what her name is off the top of my head. Right, like certainly there was some deep meaning in it, most worthy of interpretation, and which, as it were, streamed forth from the mystic symbol, subtly communicating itself to my sensibilities. Like that's not actually how things work, but it does feel like a mystery of communication, right?
Yeah.
Like you see something and you know it must mean something, but but what that means is there's a world of fluency that you're not aware of at this moment.
Yeah, and also that it feels like it's trying to convey that history is not contained in books or just one thing. And in his way of saying history is not dead, it's very much alive. Even if you don't know where it's coming from, it reaches out towards you. Like it's a living relationship that the living have with the dead in a weird way,
right.
Which Faulkner picks up on like just a little under a century later.
Yeah, and it's funny because later in this, I'm not going to play this section, but Hawthorne literally says like or implies that Pew's ghost is basically telling him to write the Scarlet Letter.
Yeah.
While thus perplexed and cogitating among other hypotheses whether the letter might not have been one of those decorations which the white men used to contrive in order to take the eyes of Indians, I happened to place it on my breast. It seemed to me.
Just a note on Hawthorne. One of the problematic things about Hawthorne's and Native Americans that keeps coming up is he implies that they're basically anti-literate, or
yeah.
Like they can't be literate, which is especially at the moment that he's writing, like the first half of the 19th century. You look at like the Cherokee Indians, or even much earlier, like the King Philip. I can't remember. It was the Wampanoags, maybe, but. Native Americans tried a lot to like assimilate and like join the culture, and that didn't fucking matter when push came to shove. And so sort of erasing that and sort of implying that they are sort of these illiterate beings is problematic.
There was some deep meaning in it, most worthy of interpretation, and which, as it were, streamed forth from the mystic symbol, subtly communicating itself to my sensibilities, but evading the analysis of my mind.
Nonetheless, I mean, it is almost definitely true that colonizers used things like, I don't know, if embroidery, but also a lot of trade goods or even guns to create those sort of psychological effects in the people that they're trying to scare away.
While thus perplexed and cogitating among other hypotheses whether the letter might not have been one of those decorations which the white men used to contrive in order to take the eyes of Indians, I happened to place it on my breast. It seemed to me, the reader may smile, but must not doubt my word, it seemed to me then that I experienced a sensation not altogether physical, yet almost so, as of burning heat, and as if the letter were not of red cloth, but red-hot iron. I shuddered and involuntarily let it fall upon the floor.
Do you have, what was your reaction to that? Like just genuine, outright, supernatural activity, basically.
Yeah, it is interesting, especially in this, the Custom House and Scarlet Letter overall, that there's almost no other moment of supernatural activity.
Well, and even in this case, like I'd say there are sort of hints at it. You know, in Scarlet Letter, there's sort of hints that Pearl is a little witch.
Yeah.
And there's other sort of like A streaks across the sky, the meteor. But all this and even this, Hawthorne puts, when you look closer, he puts little hints that this is actually down to interpretation. Like even this line.
Or it's like figuratively written.
There's a little wink, I feel like. I happened to place it on my breast. It seemed to me, and then a dash, the reader may smile, but must not doubt my word. Now, that doesn't mean like you must not doubt it because it's fucking true. It's like
yeah.
You must not doubt it because I'm the storyteller here. You're hearing a story.
Yeah. It's almost like he's like becoming a comrade with the reader, being like, yeah, I know this is like sounds ridiculous too.
Right. And we talked about that with Washington Irving too, where like
yeah.
There's certain things that I think are kind of almost, they seem to me almost cynical plays to like a sort of popular superstition, with an awareness that a more literate audience probably is beyond that sort of thing. Like, there must have been readers who read this and were like, oh, wow, that letter actually had some sort of supernatural power that could reach out and cause a burning sensation in this guy. Like, that is God works in mysterious ways, right?
Yeah. Maybe in this very room, there was two different readings.
And the thing I like about it is, and I think this is the best, this is what Hawthorne's really good at, is he's capable of finding objects that have that sort of significance baked into it. Like, I feel like we don't have the same feeling towards material things anymore because there's so much materiality. Like, we have multiple t-shirts. We don't just have, like, one veil or one blouse with a letter on it, right? Like, there's so much. But Hawthorne, like, noticed that, like, an individual thing, like a letter that looks like it's been definitely used to advertise or to signify something to a culture at large, must mean something.
Yeah, and history can transmute into things that can't orally tell you what happened.
Right.
Like, things that, like, articles of clothing that a character may have worn, like, that history is imprinted on the object indefinitely. You may not be able to recognize what it is, but at some like psychosomatic level, you know what's going on.
It is sort of a synesthesia of like the network connections around a certain artifact. Mm-hmm. And I think like the one thing I think that there's where Hawthorne sort of gets in trouble is when he sort of maybe he doesn't do this. Maybe he's just dramatizing the susceptibility of humans to do this. But do you imagine it's the object itself that has that sort of power, right? And it's actually people's relationship to it.
Yeah.
And it means nothing without that. And it obviously couldn't be produced, but it means nothing beyond, like, apart from that.
Well, and also in stark contrast with the idea that people would have relationships with anyone in this story, which has been completely relationship-free, except for the most superficial level. Like, they're essentially just dead or non-existent. Like, these forces kind of bumping into each other in, like, an infinite purgatory. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, this article comes out from a world that is intense with meaning, and it cries out to someone like Hawthorne, or the narrator, who, as being a writer of delicate sensibilities, has prepared his spirit for his whole life to be able to recognize something like this.
Right. And the other thing that made me think of Crying, the thing that made me think of Crying of Lot 49 specifically was, it had been wrought, as was easy to perceive, with wonderful skill of needlework, and the stitch, as I am assured by ladies conversant with such mysteries, gives evidence of a now forgotten art, not to be recovered even by the process of picking out the thread. Like, that is so, like, that is the sort of thing you would be fascinated by in a pre-internet world, right? Like,
yeah, that's
like,
true.
I find Hawthorne as a great collector of fascinating pre-internet things.
Like, yeah.
And all those fascinations mainly comes from the fact that these things are like sort of floating signifiers, whether it's the minister's black veil or the maypole of Marymount or the Scarlet Letter. Like, they can mean a lot of things, and that is what is, I think, ultimately attractive about them, because human beings want to know what social knowledge is embedded in those sorts of things.
In the absorbing contemplation of the Scarlet Letter, I had hitherto neglected to examine a small roll of dingy paper around which it had been twisted. This I now opened, and had the satisfaction to find, recorded by the old surveyor's pen, a reasonably complete explanation of the whole affair. There were several foolscap sheets, containing many particulars respecting the life and conversation of one Hester Prynne, who appeared to have been rather a noteworthy personage in the view of our ancestors. She had flourished during a period between the early days of Massachusetts and the close of the 17th century. Aged persons, alive in the time of Mr. Surveyor Pugh, and from whose oral testimony he had made up his narrative, remembered her in their youth as a very old but not decrepit woman, of a stately and solemn aspect. It had been her habit, from an almost immemorial date, to go about the country as a kind of voluntary nurse, and doing whatever miscellaneous good she might, taking upon herself likewise to give advice in all matters, especially those of the heart, by which means, as a person of such propensities inevitably must, she gained from many people the reverence due to an angel, but, I should imagine, was looked upon by others as an intruder and a nuisance. Prying farther into the manuscript, I found the record of other doings and sufferings of this singular woman, for the most of which the reader is referred to the story entitled The Scarlet Letter, and it should be borne carefully in mind that the main facts of that story are authorised and authenticated by the document of Mr. Surveyor Pugh.
I think that is a incredibly smart and well-crafted introduction to Hester, because, you know, what we know of Hester is she had... she committed adultery. I mean, maybe unknowingly, maybe Chillingworth was, she thought he was dead or whatever, right? But she slept with a minister and got pregnant by him. And she's already fallen in when we meet her in The Scarlet Letter. However, this starts at the end of her story, where she's a respected member of the community. And it sort of undercuts maybe one of the chief anxieties, but then also leaves that as like, oh, how does she get from here to here?
Yeah. And
I think in a way that maybe might foreclose on some of the options that he could have had with regards to what actually happens to Hester. We'll talk about that more in The Scarlet Letter. But that could be seen as unsatisfying, and it's prefigured in the Custom House here. The Custom House and The Scarlet Letter were meant to be part of a larger collection of short stories. Which is like, to consider the Scarlet Letter a short story is pretty insane to me.
Well, it started short, right, and then it got longer.
There's some dispute about that. The publisher said that there was some suggestion that was the case, but apparently no, he had nothing to do with the length, and this was just how long it was going to be.
Oh, seriously?
Yeah, so it was going to be Custom House, Scarlet Letter, and a bunch of other short stories. And I mean, Scarlet Letter, I don't know exactly how long it is. It's
like 200 pages.
It's like two, yeah.
So I guess without the Custom House, like 150.
Okay.
So it's in that novella territory.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But novellas stand alone still. You don't jam a novella. Well, I guess at the end.
Maybe at this time you did. Because, I mean, we're still in the sort of like influenced. He mentions Rip Van Winkle. Or not Rip Van Winkle. He mentions Sleepy Hollow. Or which one is it? Or Rip Van Winkle.
Oh, yeah. It would be so lopsided to include...
Oh, meanwhile, the press has taken up my affair and kept me for a week or two careering through the public prints in my decapitated state like Irving's Headless Horseman. And that, like, sketch model is sort of like what this is expanding on.
Yeah. Cute. Without getting into The Scarlet Letter, but I love the symmetry between the way that the Custom House starts and The Scarlet Letter starts, which is it's two people who had something calamitous had just happened to them.
Yeah.
And... it's almost you, and that's always kind of shrouded in mystery for Hawthorne. It's for political reasons. Like, I got fired. I don't know what happened.
Yeah, yeah.
And then for Hester Prynne, you don't know what was the nature of the relationship, but you know that they're both like fallen from societal grace in that moment.
Yeah, Elisa New, the Harvard professor that we heard from a bit earlier in the clip, she actually teaches the classes on the literature of failure. Mm. And notes that, yeah, they both start in that way from failure. And now we'll go to how Hawthorne attempts to compose this Scarlet Letter. We'll skip the part where Surveyor Pugh is like, from beyond the grave, sort of saying, "Is it, do this," said the ghost of Mr. Surveyor Pugh, emphatically nodding with the head. Yeah, it's kind of an interesting part, but we're going to move on a bit to how he... actually attempts to do that. And this sort of, I think, as an insight into the like what romance is, high romance, this is a fairly important section of the introduction here.
Cessa's memory, the credit which will be rightfully its due. And I said to the ghost of Mr. Surveyor Pugh, I will. On Hester Prynne's story, therefore, I bestowed much thought. It was the subject of my meditations for many an hour, while pacing to and fro across my room, or traversing with a hundredfold repetition the long extent from the front door of the Custom House to the side entrance and back again. Great were the weariness and annoyance of the old inspector and the weighers and gaugers, whose slumbers were disturbed by the unmercifully lengthened tramp of my passing and returning footsteps. Remembering their own former habits, they used to say that the surveyor was walking the quarter-deck. They probably fancied that my sole object, and indeed the sole object for which a sane man could ever put himself into voluntary motion, was to get an appetite for dinner. And to say the truth, an appetite, sharpened by the east wind that generally blew along the passage, was the only valuable result of so much indefatigable exercise. So little adapted is the atmosphere of a custom house to the delicate harvest of fancy and sensibility that had I remained there through 10 presidencies yet to come, I doubt whether the tale of the Scarlet Letter would ever have been brought before the public eye. My imagination was a tarnished mirror. It would not reflect, or only with miserable dimness, the figures with which I did my best to people it. The characters of the narrative would not be warmed and rendered malleable by any heat that I could kindle at my intellectual forge. They would take neither the glow of passion nor the tenderness of sentiment, but retained all the rigidity of dead corpses, and stared me in the face with a fixed and ghastly grin of contemptuous defiance. "What have you to do with us?" that expression seemed to say. "The little power you might once have possessed over the tribe of unrealities is gone. You have bartered it for a pittance of the public gold. Go then and earn your wages." In short, the almost torpid creatures of my own fancy twitted me with imbecility, and not without fair occasion. It was not merely during the 3 hours and a half which Uncle Sam claimed as his share of my daily life that this wretched number held possession of me. It went with me on my seashore walks and rambles into the country, whenever, which was seldom and reluctantly, I bestirred myself to seek that invigorating charm of nature, which used to give me such freshness and activity of thought the moment that I stepped across the threshold of the old manse. The same torpor, as regarded the capacity for intellectual effort, accompanied me home and weighed upon me in the chamber, which I most absurdly termed my study.
I can't remember who it is, but is it Thoreau or Emerson that considered Hawthorne their great walking partner in life? One of them did, and that was a nice little reference to that, or that he was quite the walker, I guess.
The perambulist? Yeah, I'm not sure, actually. I know that him and Melville corresponded a lot, but I don't know who...
I think it's Emerson.
Emerson? Yeah. It could be either Emerson or Thoreau.
I most absurdly termed my study. Nor did it quit me when late at night I sat in the deserted parlour, lighted only by the glimmering coal fire and the moon, striving to picture forth imaginary scenes which, the next day, might flow out on the brightening page in many-hued description. If the imaginative faculty refused to act at such an hour, it might well be deemed a hopeless case. Moonlight in a familiar room, falling so white upon the carpet, and showing all its figures so distinctly, making every object so minutely visible, yet so unlike a morning or noontide visibility, is a medium the most suitable for a romance writer to get acquainted with his elusive guests. There is the little domestic scenery of the well-known apartment, the chairs, with each its separate individuality, the centre table sustaining a work-basket, a volume or two, and an extinguished lamp, the sofa, the bookcase, the picture on the wall, all these details so completely seen are so spiritualized by the unusual light that they seem to lose their actual substance and become things of intellect. Nothing is too small or too trifling to undergo this change and acquire dignity thereby. A child's shoe, the doll seated in her little wicker carriage, the hobby horse, whatever, in a word, has been used or played with during the day, is now invested with a quality of strangeness and remoteness, though still almost as vividly present as by daylight. Thus, therefore, the floor of our familiar room has become a neutral territory, somewhere between the real world and fairyland, where the actual and the imaginary may meet, and each imbue itself with the nature of the other. Ghosts might enter here without affrighting us. It would be too much in keeping with the scene to excite surprise, were we to look about us and discover a form, beloved but gone hence, now sitting quietly in a streak of this magic moonshine, with an aspect that would make us doubt whether it had returned from afar or had never once stirred from our fireside. The somewhat dim coal fire has an essential influence in producing the effect which I would describe. It throws its unobtrusive tinge throughout the room, with a faint ruddiness upon the walls and ceiling and a reflected gleam from the polish of the furniture. This warmer light mingles itself with the cold spirituality of the moonbeams, and communicates, as it were, a heart and sensibilities of human tenderness to the forms which fancy summons up. It converts them from snow images into men and women. Glancing at the looking-glass, we behold, deep within its haunted verge, the smouldering glow of the half-extinguished anthracite, the white moonbeams on the floor, and a repetition of all the gleam and shadow of the picture, with one remove farther from the actual and nearer to the imaginative. Then, at such an hour, and with this scene before him, if a man sitting all alone cannot dream strange things and make them look like truth, he need never try to write romances. But for myself, during the whole of my custom-house experience, moonlight and sunshine and the glow of firelight were just alike in my regard, and neither of them was of one whit more avail than the twinkle of a tallow candle. An entire class of susceptibilities, and a gift connected with them, of no great richness or value, but the best I had, was gone from me.
I think there's a lot in his moonlight imagery there, right? Mm-hmm. Like, it throws your surroundings into different relief. I mean, I've even noticed in times where I'm in my apartment at a different time of the day that I usually am, and the sun's coming from, you know, like a different window, right? Like, there is something uncanny about the way different sort of light can throw different objects into relief. And then to have something, especially like the sun versus the moon, right? And you sort of like the way the last of the sunlight is, or the last of a lamplight is playing off of versus a moon, and you see them overcross it. I think that actually gives some insight, even to some perhaps the politics of Hawthorne's writing, which, as we said earlier, are never often on one side or the other of an issue, really, unless they just ignore the issue entirely.
Yeah, there's definitely a duality, or a dialectic, really, at play, both in Custom House and in Scarlet Letter, particularly with the characters that are focused on, because they both have a public and private persona that are radically different. And those public personas, like, sometimes are put on, and sometimes they're forced on the characters. And so it takes a change of scenery, essentially. Like, the Earth has that duality, or the day's circadian rhythm has a duality to it as well. And we mirror, I guess, humanity and culture mirrors that complex. I don't know.
Yeah. And then he saves, like, I think maybe his most vitriolic anti-government screed for the end here.
But nevertheless, it is anything but agreeable to be haunted by a suspicion that one's intellect is dwindling away, or exhaling without your consciousness like ether out of a phial, so that at every glance you find a smaller and less volatile residuum. Of the fact there could be no doubt, and examining myself and others, I was led to conclusions in reference to the effect of public office on the character, not very favourable to the mode of life in question. In some other form, perhaps, I may hereafter develop these effects. Suffice it here to say that a custom house officer of long continuance can hardly be a very praiseworthy or respectable personage for many reasons. One of them, the tenure by which he holds his situation, and another, the very nature of his business, which, though I trust an honest one, is of such a sort that he does not share in the united effort of mankind. An effect, which I believe to be observable more or less in every individual who has occupied the position, is that, while he leans on the mighty arm of the Republic, his own proper strength departs from him. He loses, in an extent proportioned to the weakness or force of his original nature, the capability of self-support. If he possess an unusual share of native energy, or the enervating magic of place do not operate too long upon him, his forfeited powers may be redeemable. The ejected officer, fortunate in the unkindly shove that sends him forth betimes to struggle amid a struggling world, may return to himself and become all that he has ever been. But this seldom happens. He usually keeps his ground just long enough for his own ruin, and is then thrust out, with sinews all unstrung, to totter along the difficult footpath of life as best he may. Conscious of his own infirmity, that his tempered steel and elasticity are lost, he for ever afterwards looks wistfully about him in quest of support external to himself. His pervading and continual hope, a hallucination, which, in the face of all discouragement and making light of impossibilities, haunts him while he lives, and, I fancy, like the convulsive throes of the cholera, torments him for a brief space after death, is that finally, and in no long time, by some happy coincidence of circumstances, he shall be restored to office. This faith, more than anything else, steals the pith and availability out of whatever enterprise he may dream of undertaking. Why should he toil and moil, and be at so much trouble, to pick himself up out of the mud, when, in a little while hence, the strong arm of his uncle will raise and support him? Why should he work for his living here, or go to dig gold in California, when he is so soon to be made happy at monthly intervals with a little pile of glittering coin out of his uncle's pocket? It is sadly curious to observe how slight a taste of office suffices to infect a poor fellow with this singular disease. Uncle Sam's gold, meaning no disrespect to the worthy old gentleman, has, in this respect, a quality of enchantment like that of the devil's wages. Whoever touches it should look well to himself, or he may find the bargain to go hard against him, involving, if not his soul, yet many of its better attributes, its sturdy force, its courage and constancy, its truth, its self-reliance, and all that gives the emphasis to manly character.
Yeah, so fuck you, Nathaniel Hawthorne. Like, you get these amazing artifacts that you're going to, like, weave into stories. A lot of leisure from that. And then you say all that shit.
It's unfortunate, too, because it's peppered with the language of Ralph Waldo Emerson and his essays. And it just sucks that that's his takeaway.
Yeah.
Like, that's like, yes, the government should be limited in the social safety net, and you should just, you know, go and mine for gold, which is such a worthless way to spend your life.
And we also know he didn't fucking go to mine for gold.
Yeah, well, they never do.
I mean, but he literally, this wasn't even the last time he was doing this sort of job,
yeah.
Right? His main employment throughout his entire life is customs houses.
Yeah.
So that he could say you couldn't be a respectable personage is just like, oh, yeah, you're pissed, you're frosty, you got thrown out of office. Like, and you're like, yeah, glad. He actually literally says at one point that he felt, when he got thrown out of office, like a suicidal man that met a murderer. Right? Like,
yeah, that's awesome.
And it's like, yeah, okay. I mean, all right. So just to wrap up, let's play a bit from this. This is from Dustin Hannum. The title of this article is Sermons Out of Rags, Constitutionalism, Conspiracy Theory, and Reading the Scarlet Letter in Hawthorne's Custom House. This is from Papers on Language and Literature, Spring 2015.
This same anxiety about the tension between individual interpretation and cohesion permeates the Custom House, marking it as a text deeply engaged in, rather than evasive of, the political problems of its time. Finding Signs, Reading the Scarlet Letter. The Custom House, though described in its title as introductory to the Scarlet Letter, functions peculiarly as both beginning and ending of the novel. It is by now well known that the sketch was written as an introduction for an intended collection of sketches, of which the Scarlet Letter was only to be the longest. But it also functioned as a beginning by being a marketing vehicle for the Scarlet Letter. The sketch appeared in the spring of 1850, following several notices for the upcoming novel, in the advertised New York literary world. As William Charvet points out in his introduction to the centenary edition of the Scarlet Letter, the sketch went a long way in creating any anticipation for the novel that existed among the reading public with its send-up of the old inspector of the Salem Custom House. The relative success of the novel and that a slight one was largely due to this publicity push. Yet this purpose, the advance notice of the upcoming novel from the recently ousted surveyor, also demonstrates how the Custom House serves as ending. It is, among other things, the recounting of how the narrator lost his job, a sacrifice to the federal spoils system that had, by 1849, become a major part of American national politics. 10. The narrator opens the sketch by justifying its inclusion, claiming that while some authors indulge themselves in the scarcely decorous disclosure of such confidential depths of revelation as could fittingly be addressed, only and exclusively, to the one heart and mind of perfect sympathy, it is acceptable to prate of the circumstances that lie around us, and even of ourself, but still keep the inmost me behind its veil. But his true purpose, he claims, is to relate how a large portion of the following pages came into my possession and offer proofs of the authenticity of a narrative therein contained. This, in fact, dash a desire to put myself in my true position as editor, or very little more, of the most prolix among the tales that make up my volume dash this, and no other, is my true reason for assuming a personal relationship with the public. There is, then, a certain symmetry here, as Bryce Traister has pointed out. Traister suggests that Hawthorne, in his sketch, is dramatizing a kind of neutral bureaucratic ideal with his narrator. An ideal bureaucrat, as public servant, merely administers the public will. This notion of administering rather than inventing political will, according to Traister, finds a specific literary analog in the relation between editing and authoring texts. 85. Both positions suggest a degree of impersonal neutrality and invested interpretive authority. To put it slightly differently, both positions suggest a reader rather than a writer. As Traister argues, if the authority of civic government ultimately resides in the sovereignty of the people, then the disinterested public servant's autonomy, his or her distance from either majority or minority political wills, ironically makes possible the practice of democratic government. But if the bureaucratic ideal is that of a neutral public sphere removed from political wills, Hawthorne's narrator tells a very different story about Salem politics, in two regards. First, he casts his dismissal in terms of a political beheading, suggesting that his position was anything but protected from political wills. Second, he claims that the materialistic everyday concerns of Custom House life prevented him from even being able to perform his role as editor, or very little more, of the Scarlet Letter. During his tenure as a Custom House employee, literature, its exertions, and objects, were now of little moment in my regard. I cared not, at this period, for books, Hawthorne 1, 25-26. And so, even after he had found the Scarlet Letter among a collection of the deceased surveyor Pugh's private writings and belongings, the narrator argues that so little adapted is the atmosphere of a Custom House to the delicate harvest of fancy and sensibility, had I remained there through 10 presidencies yet to come, I doubt whether the tale of the Scarlet Letter would ever have been brought before the public eye. It was only after his decapitation that the lucubrations of my ancient predecessor, Mr. Surveyor Pugh, came into play. Rusty through long idleness, some little space was requisite before my intellectual machinery could be brought to work upon the tale, with an effect in any degree satisfactory. And so, the sketch tells the story of how the narrator's political death, his decapitation dash, became the beginning of the Scarlet Letter. 11. The obvious reading of this story, in light of critiques such as Arrak's, would be to argue that this is part of Hawthorne staking out the position of the apolitical romantic author. When the narrator claims that, keeping up the metaphor of the political guillotine that he has used throughout his description of his dismissal, the whole may be considered as the posthumous papers of a decapitated surveyor, Hawthorne 1, 43, one possible conclusion the narrator's own is that only as a politically dead man could he become again a literary man.
And I actually think there's probably something to that. Like, I think it probably... Like, I have long harbored... I mean, I was an English major in college. Deep down, if you're asking me, like, what would be the ultimate success, it would be to, like, write a novel that was, like, up there with the greatest all time, right?
But yeah.
But I haven't written in maybe 5 years. Mm-hmm. Because I have other stuff going on, and, like, you get... Like, for instance, like, now, it's like I get home, I don't really want to sit down to write. There's certain things that I think are conducive to that sort of mindset of actually producing and being a writer. Whereas, like, if you're apolitical, sort of a reader, a upholder of the Constitution, it's not me being political, I'm just following the Constitution or the laws, right? Mm-hmm. You might be picking up material that you can later turn into literature, but you can't actually do anything with it at the time.
Yeah. I like how the narrator talks about his return to Salem as if it might possibly be the center of the universe. And there's this paradox that's happening at the center of this story, and then also Scarlet Letter, of the only way to be free or to be a liberated human is to accept your fate, essentially, to go with this, like, whether it's divine or just like in a Sophoclean Oedipus sense, like this is just what your fate is.
Right.
But you're meant to be, he's meant to be at Salem and meant to want to leave Salem at the same time, in the same way that Hester Prynne is, that has struggles with the exact same thing. She's going to define what Salem is, but all the while wanting to escape it. But right. Her fate is to be at the heart of it.
Yeah, it's sort of like and the main project or the main romance is in appreciating the pathos of that.
Yeah,
it's not necessarily doing anything about it.
Yeah, the romance is finding the liberation in going towards your destiny, which is non-liberatory by definition.
Yeah. Any final thoughts on?
No, that was
Custom
it.
House? Yeah, I mean, I think we've headed toward our destiny.
Yeah, the Scarlet Letter.
The Scarlet Letter. That is I don't know if it's going to be the first one released. That's not just me and you.
Get excited.
We're going to. There's going to be a female voice. Some of you may have heard her before, Kara. She'll be on the Scarlet Letter episode. I'm unsure if that's going to come out immediately following this one. I have a few other balls sort of up in the air. Alex and I and Grace are going to record on Hope Leslie. I've been teasing that for a while. What's sort of holding that up is I'm trying to line up an interview, and I think it's going to happen. I'm feeling pretty
confident.
Now
that it's recorded, it'll definitely happen.
I think it is, and it's going to be good. So we'll see. It's still undetermined, but thank you very much for listening. Follow Alex on Twitter at Alex_guns, Alex spelled Alexcks.
Yep.
I'm at Matt Leck. You probably already follow me. let's just be honest.
This is the part of the way we need to get Alex more followers.
Yeah, exactly. Also, at Lit Hangover on Twitter. Literary Hangover's on YouTube. We're all over the podcast players. And if you're not a patron, it'd be nice to have some more patrons. So become a patron. Patreon.com/literaryhangover. Thank you very much, Alex, once again.
It was great.
And we'll see you again in a couple weeks.